Good afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Monroe Carman. I'm president of the club, as well as editor-at-large at Bloomberg Business News. I'd like to welcome all our club members here in the audience with their guests, also those of you watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I want to remind you of some speakers that are coming up on Wednesday, tomorrow. Agriculture Secretary Dan Glickman will be with us, and I'm sure he'll have some things to say about the Farm Bill moved through Congress. And on Thursday, October 19th, we'll have a discussion, yes, debate is more appropriate, on the budget by Alice Rivlin, Director of the Office of Management and Budget, and John Kasich, Chairman of the House Budget Committee. Then on Friday, we'll have the 20th of October, Louis Rukeyser, host of Wall Street Week. With Louis Rukeyser, will be here in conjunction with the National Press Club's annual Financial Writers Conference. That'll be an all-day long affair on Friday, the 20th. Transcripts and video and audio tapes of Press Club luncheons are available by calling 1-800-NPC-2334. I'm also pleased to announce that the National Press Club has just published a new book. It's called The National Press Club's Best Contemporary Speakers. It's a compendium of the best speeches that we heard in 1994. And if you wish to order a copy, why, again, please call 1-800-NPC-2334. If you have any questions for our speaker, you'll find cards at your table. Please write your questions on those cards, pass them up, and I will ask as many as time permits. And now I would like to introduce our head table and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. From your right, Linda Killian, freelance journalist, William Salisbury, St. Paul Pioneer Press, Robert Ritter, editor of Gannett News Service, Kelly Smith, assistant bureau chief, Money Magazine, Regina Blakely, CBS News, Paul Berry, anchor, WJLA-TV, Washington, D.C. Skipping over our guests for the moment, Ike Pappas of Ike Pappas Network Production and member of the National Press Club Speakers Committee who arranged today's luncheon. Thank you, Ike. Moving on down, Deborah Gersh Hernandez, Washington editor for Editor and Publisher Magazine. Mark Miller, managing editor, Broadcasting and Cable Magazine. Sandra McElwain, freelance journalist, and she's the person who produces our book and author rap sessions here at the club. Don Dudley, News Channel 8, Washington, D.C., and William Brannigan, Public Information Officer for the World Bank. Our guest speaker today is Don Shewitt, executive producer of 60 Minutes. As you know, PBS's 60 Minutes is not just one of the most successful news broadcasts in the history of journalism. It is one of the most successful and profitable programs of any kind in the history of the medium. And it was Don Shewitt who created 60 Minutes. That was 27 years ago. Since that time, we have followed the globe-trotting adventures of Mike and Morley and Ed and Harry and Leslie and the rest of the troop as they exposed the bad guys, celebrated the good guys, and examined the human condition. Today, the ratings remain so strong that 60 Minutes will probably stay on the air until Andy Rooney runs out of humor. 60 Minutes has been honored with the Gold Baton, the highest of the Alfred I. DuPont Columbia University Awards in Broadcast Journalism, and has been inducted into the National Association of Broadcasters Hall of Fame. Don Shewitt himself, excuse me, has been honored with many of the most distinguished honors in broadcast journalism. The list includes 7 Emmys, 2 Peabody, a Polk, and a spot in the Television Academy Hall of Fame. Mr. Hewitt came to 60 Minutes after producing a string of award-winning specials, including coverage of political conventions and the coronation Queen Hope. He also produced the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. Back in 1960, I remember this well, he brought us the historic Kennedy-Nixon debates, offering the Republican candidate some advice decided not to heed. Cosmetic makeup is not a bad idea when you're going on television. Didn't you get a chuckle out of that one? I'm sorry.
I chuckled. They did.
Oh, they did. Don Hewitt got into television 47 years ago as an associate director of a little program on a new and little seen medium. It was called Douglas Edwards with the News. Does anybody remember that? Sure. Notwithstanding this illustrious history in television news, the real reason we are honored to have Mr. Hewitt with us today, not because of electronic, because he has printer's ink beneath his manic fingernails. Do you know he started his career back in 1942 as a copy boy on the old New York Herald Tribune, which I grew up with?
That was the best job I ever had.
That's right. Perhaps because of his experience in both print and electronic journalism, Mr. Hewitt now is raising provocative questions about a very serious topic of the day, the wisdom of allowing cameras in the courtroom. In a recent column in the New York Times, he asked, quote, "Has TV done irreparable damage to the criminal justice system by laying claim to a camera in the courtroom? I doubt it. But has TV made itself look foolish and unfeeling by turning a murder trial into TV's longest-running entertainment special? I think so. Some things," he said, "are best left untelevised. O.J. Simpson, Lance Ito, Cato Kaelin, Johnny Cochran, Marsha Clark, and Rosa Lopez show, where 99 cents but saw the light of day, could be on the cutting room floor or at least in a reporter's wastebasket." Today, our speaker will expand upon these and other thoughts. Ladies and gentlemen, a warm welcome, please, for Don Hewitt.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Somebody said to me, how do you feel about this honor of coming here to be a speaker at the press club? And I said, I love any honor that isn't posthumous. I get asked a lot about just what in hell does a television producer do? Well, the job of a television producer is, pure and simple, put on a broadcast, will draw a big enough crowd to make it attractive for an advertiser to shell out big enough bucks, buy the right, interrupt whatever it is that crowd is watching, to peddle whatever it is that advertiser is selling. So what's new about that? What's new about that is that broadcast journalists didn't used to be caught up in that game. Drawing a big crowd isn't necessarily bad, but if you're in journalism, but that's all that you're about. However, when a Barbara Walters draws a bigger than usual crowd with a Colin Powell or a Christopher Reeve, that's not the kind of anything for a buck television I'm talking about. That's first-rate television and first-rate journalism, and would be even if it didn't draw a crowd, which it did, and deservedly so. I'd like to think that people feel more or less the same about 60 Minutes. God knows the imitators piled on like circus acrobats. Some good, some bad, some atrocious. 2020, Primetime Live, 48 Hours, and Dateline among the good ones. Now, in that regard, there isn't anyone here in this room, is there, who really believes Tom Murphy, Jack Welch, Larry Tisch, and Rupert Murdoch woke up one morning and said to themselves, you know, we're not doing enough to inform the American public. Plain fact is, they woke up one morning, 10 years too late, and said to themselves, can you believe the amount of money that 60 Minutes makes? Now, it's no trick to make money and to draw a crowd. The folk hero in the dock accused of cutting his wife's throat, that's like shooting ducks in a barrel. Anybody can do that. Same goes for covering a wife or cut off her husband's whatchamacallit, ducks in a barrel. The real trick is to draw a crowd, and the story is inner city kids studying Shakespeare and Chaucer, doctors studying the effects of Prozac, Vietnam amputees studying the ways to put their lives back together. I'm not sure I know why, but staying on the high road has kept 60 Minutes in the top 10 longer than any other show in television. Longer than MASH, longer than All in the Family, longer even than I Love Lucy. How can that be? But no Lorena Bobbitts, no Joey Buttafuoco's, no Cato Kaelins, no Heidi Fleiss's. How could we have been America's top-rated show once in the 70s, once in the 80s, twice in the 90s? How do we do it? Try this. 27 years ago, when we first started 60 Minutes, we were given one mandate: make us proud. We got it from Bill Leonard, who was our boss at the time, known to some of you here, certainly to Ike. In the last 28 years, I don't recall anyone else in television saying to anyone else in television, make us proud. What they say is make us money. Nobody ever said that to us. And despite it, or maybe because of it, we made them money. A lot of money. About $1.5 billion in pure profit makes 60 Minutes the most profitable broadcast in television history. Is it getting harder and harder to stay on top? You betcha. Especially when the first half of your show is opposite the end of a football game, used to be your lead-in. And in a major share of major markets, nobody can find the channel you're on. But, the man said, you play the hand you're dealt. True, but I liked it better when the hand we were dealt didn't come from a deck that was stacked. Let's face it, I'm the last one in the world who could grouse about a stacked deck. 28 years, we were lucky enough to draw nothing but full houses and royal flushes. Still do. The problem is, there aren't that many kibitzers around the table anymore. Now, isn't that enough to make a guy very tempted to veer off onto the low road? Yeah, tempted. Not very. Ever tempted by O.J.? Of course. We could have had him. That's a story I would have killed for. Unfortunate phrase, I know. But notice I said killed for and not paid for. What about K.O. Caitlin? Nicole's sisters. O.J.'s mother. O.J.'s kids. Even for free. That's not what we're about. And that brings us to what I said about cameras in the courtroom and infuriated so many of my colleagues. What seemed to upset them most was my saying television doesn't have to go everywhere and that a door slammed in our face once in a while would probably be good for our soul, at the very least for our hubris, although not for our pocketbook. This year's box office smash was the television opus, Who Killed Ron and Nicole? It wasn't too long ago television box office smash was Who Killed J.R.? Television does have a way, doesn't it, of making crime pay. If it didn't, the hue and cry about television in the courtroom would not be an issue. Cherche la commercial, as in dial-a-mattress, which was just one of several commercials CNN interrupted Johnny Cochran's summation for, not during a pause, but in mid-sentence, and not once, but several times. How eager, I wonder, would television be to put a camera in a courtroom if a judge said, okie doke, you can televise my courtroom, can't sell it. How long do you think CNN and Court TV and E for Entertainment would have stayed around if there weren't commercial interruptions? Take it one step further. Judge says, how would you like to bid for the television rights to my trial? Boy, would the city of Los Angeles love to hand the O.J. bill to the guys who made money on the O.J. trial. If the last act of this television extravaganza took you by surprise, remember, surprise ending, great theater. And theater is what this granddaddy of all television shows was about. Even down to the unseen jury in the wings making its first appearance on stage just before the curtain fell. E.T. Barnum couldn't have planned it better. Crowd waits with bated breath. I never knew what bated breath was, but crowds always wait with it. And it all comes down to a little piece of paper handed to Judge Ito. I mean, Broadway and Hollywood could never top that. Did the jury get it right? Well, if they didn't, they weren't the first ones not to. They weren't the first ones to let someone who did it go free, or someone who didn't do it go to jail. Does the former make up for the latter? No. But it goes a long way toward explaining why the great divide in this country keeps getting wider. Now, let's talk a little about that other great divide, the one between Democrats and Republicans, also known as liberals and conservatives. Although I'm damned if I know what's conservative about selling arms to the Ayatollah and liberal about denying arms to the Muslims. If I'm not as excited as some of my colleagues about the political year coming up, you'll have to pardon me. I've been around this track a dozen times. Truman and Dewey, Eisenhower and Stevenson twice, Kennedy and Nixon, Johnson and Goldwater, Nixon and Humphrey, Nixon and McGovern, Ford and Carter, Carter and Reagan, Reagan and Mondale, Bush and Dukakis, Bush and Clinton, and a fella get a little out of breath making that longer run. To me,
Politics
are getting more and more like Alice in Wonderland. Politicians keep getting curiouser and curiouser. They all cheat. Now, let me amend that. They all fudge. Goes with the territory. FDR said he'd balance the budget. Reagan said he'd cut the deficit. Lyndon Johnson said he would never bomb Hanoi. Remember the old joke? He told me if I voted for Barry Goldwater, we'd end up bombing North Vietnam. And they were right. Voted for Barry Goldwater, and we ended up bombing North Vietnam. Now, what to do about the endless political year that's already begun? How about, for starters, outlawing paid political commercials? That would shorten the year, turn things around. No longer would politicians sell favors to lobbyists to get the money to pay for TV time. I know the argument. Can't outlaw paid political commercials without trampling on the First Amendment. Ain't so. Television doesn't take cigarette commercials or hard liquor commercials. How about their First Amendment rights? Aside from freeing us from the clutches of lobbyists, tobacco and otherwise, outlawing paid political ads would raise the quality of the dialogue. I don't know about you. I'm never sure whether I'm voting for a candidate or a copywriter. Nothing about the industry I've been a part of for 44 years needs fixing more than the relationship between it and politicians. Some of it is inevitable. A lot of it isn't. Take the amount of time the networks give over to covering the Democratic and Republican national conventions. Except when they get around to balloting, political conventions are nothing more than two big parties, thrown by two big parties, hosted by three or four anchormen, maybe five now that Fox wants to get in the act, who should know better than to give all that hot air, all that hot air time. The focus of a political convention is supposed to be the rostrum, the spot where they're going to nominate the next president of the United States. The rostrum is lost in a sea of television booths that go up like condominiums, proclaim in Times Square-sized signs, CBS News, ABC News, NBC News, CNN. There's no doubt whose convention this really is, ours. Just compare the size of the signs. Just compare our sign, those other guys, the ones with the little signs on a stick that say California, Missouri, Massachusetts. Those people end up being extras in our television show. In 1948, when I started covering political conventions, I did the two that nominated Harry Truman and Tom Dewey, the third that nominated Henry Wallace. How many? I bet there's nobody here who's ever heard that name before. A couple of people. There were no anchor booths, hence no network signs, upstaging the candidates, and no debates. 12 years later, I was the John Ringling North of the first one of those confrontations that we misnamed debate. When it was over, it dawned on me that maybe we shouldn't be picking a president because he comes off as a better television performer, although I think we probably got the right one that time around. Think back for a moment about television debates. The only thing anyone remembers about Nixon-Kennedy, Nixon's makeup. The only thing they remember about Ford and Carter was Ford's gaffe about Poland. The only thing they remember about Reagan-Carter was Reagan saying to Carter, "There you go again." The only thing they remember about Dukakis-Bush, Dukakis being asked how he would react if his wife was raped. And if anyone here remembers anything other than "you're no Jack Kennedy" from the Quayle Benson debate, I've yet to meet him. Of course, there's always the pundit who says of the Nixon-Kennedy debate, "Well, what they said about Kimoi and Matsu was surely more important than Nixon's makeup," to which I always respond, "Okay, which one said what, and where the hell is Kimoi and Matsu?" And no, it wasn't more important than Nixon's makeup. To make the debates real debates, the late Theodore White and I once proposed that the making of a president might have more meaning. Television provided airtime for the two or maybe three candidates vying for the job to debate in front of a joint session of Congress. Each candidate would bring with him his own debating team. Let it go 2 hours, and during the second hour, like Britain's backbench, let the Democrats in Congress have a go at the Republican candidate, and the Republicans in Congress have a go at the Democratic candidate. And let everybody have a go at Ross Perot or Colin Powell or whoever. No holds barred. A real Capitol Hill gang. We thought we had a great idea. No one else did. Maybe we should have brought it here to the press club and had it aired on C-SPAN and National Public Radio. Maybe somebody would have paid attention. Question time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. What reaction have you received from your comments on TV coverage of the O.J. trial? I read somewhere where you called the turncoat Benedict Arnold and a few other unkind.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, everybody makes this assumption. But the right to know is synonymous with the right to watch. And you have a right to know what's going on. You don't have a right to watch everything. The coverage of the trial reminded me, and the whole jury thing, of the guy who was asked, if you were on trial for murder, would you rather be tried in front of a jury of your peers or a panel of judges? He said, a panel of judges. And the guy said, well, why do you say that? He said, you think I want to leave my fate to 12 people who aren't smart enough to get out of jury duty? That's what I kind of felt about the trial. And yet, here's a guy who goes on trial in front of a jury of his peers. They saw maybe one-third of what the country saw. This was a television show. Television does not belong in courtrooms. Courtrooms are for a man or a woman to go on trial in front of a jury that listens to all the evidence from beginning to end and then makes a determination. What you have when you put it on television, you're being judged by someone who says to his wife, hey, Mildred, come on in, they got the gloves now. Hey, Mildred, look, there are the shoes. Nobody is watching this from beginning to end as a jury should, and we're all sitting. And if you wonder why the jury verdict caused so many problems in this country and divided the country, I don't think it would have if everybody hadn't sat there and watched that trial and became part of it. And what happened was everybody at home assumed that they were the jury and they were going to make a determination. Well, they weren't the jury. They didn't make a determination, and they resent the fact that the jury didn't vote the way they would have voted. It's a good place to keep cameras out of.
All right, says the questioner. While I applaud your questioning, TV in the courtroom, I still have difficulty justifying allowing print media in the courtroom but barring electronic media. How do you resolve that?
Let electronic guys go in with a notebook. If the whole idea of allowing the press in is to protect the rights of the defendant, so it's not a star chamber, you know, let the Ike Pappases in along with the David Margalits of the New York Times. Let them sit there and watch the trial. Let them report on it. The trial, that a courtroom is not a television studio, and that's what it became, and it took over America. I mean, I never remember, as they say, it was bigger than Who Killed J.R. It took over this country in a way that did a disservice to the judicial system, did a disservice to television, and I think it did a disservice to the American.
What was your opinion of Andy Rooney's pieces on O.A. and you might have pieces did communicate? And do you have a veto over what Andy Rooney does in his answer?
I sure do, but I'm afraid to exercise it. Andy, on one thing, offered $1 million if somebody would come forward with the names of the, what he called the real killers, if Andy didn't know who he thought the real killer was. And then last week he did the piece on O.J. was coming as his guest, but at the last minute called up and said he wouldn't be there. And Andy said, you know, what are you doing? Let Johnny Cochran push you around? You can come. It's only me. Brian Gumbel isn't here. No, Andy is a columnist, and columnists traditionally have said what they want to say, and they just go on saying it, and sometimes I agree, sometimes I disagree, but they love me.
We all know about the canceled appearance of Mr. Simpson on NBC. Do you think he should be invited to give his views on commercial television, and under what terms would you issue such an invitation?
Same terms that NBC issued it. No holes barred. I got calls from columnists all over the country. What do you think about O.J. Simpson going on NBC? I said, I wish it were me. I would have loved it. And I can't believe that Tom Brokaw would be a party to anything less than a no holes barred interview. I think because NBC News stuck to their guns and said nothing's off limits, we can ask him about anything, and it's a no holes barred interview, I think that's why he backed out. I think this is baloney, where he said, I thought we were going to have a conversation, and now it's a confrontation. I think he was told right off the bat it was a confrontation, and then the lawyer who's going to handle his civil suit probably called up and said, what are you, out of your mind? You can't do this right now. I didn't understand why now was so furious at NBC. I can't imagine that Katie Couric and Tom Brokaw wouldn't have zeroed in on wife-beating and those pictures of her beat up, and I have no idea why now was so furious if they were going to put him on and give him the grilling that he never got because he wouldn't take the witness stand. I would have liked to have heard Marcia Clark grill him, but they didn't want that, so I just soon hear Brokaw and Katie Couric do it, and I thought they would have been great.
All right, so that's the easy question. Now we get to the harder ones. What, in your view, has caused CBS as a network to take such a precipitous plunge in the ratings?
I knew you were going to say it. Come on.
And do you see anything in the deal with Westinghouse that could make a difference?
Everybody says, what happened to CBS? What happened to CBS was Bill Paley died. Bill Paley died having made a terrible decision not to give the company to a man named Frank Stanton. And all of you here who had worked at CBS know exactly what I'm talking about. We had a series of senior executives, one worse than the last one, ending up with a man who just sold CBS to Westinghouse, who was a monumental success as an investor and a monumental failure as a broadcaster. Had Paley had the foresight to give this company to Frank Stanton, I don't think it would be in the trouble it's in today. There's nothing there. It's like a disaster area. Will it get better this year? No, it will not get better this year. It's so mired in third place, could slip into fourth place, and if there was another network, could be in fifth place. Now, Westinghouse. I'll tell you a story. Mike Jordan, the day that Westinghouse took over, called me, and he said, Don, I just want to check in. You're the broadcast that's most important to us, and I just want you to know how much I want to rejuvenate CBS News and how important CBS News is to me, and we're going to bring it back as a great organization. And I said, gee, that's terrific. And he said, I want to come and see you next week. And I said, wow, thank you. That's marvelous. And I hung up and I called Leslie Stahl. And I said, hey, Les, guess what? Mike Jordan, chairman of Westinghouse, just called. You know what he said? He said he wants to rejuvenate CBS News. He wants to bring it back and he wants to make it great again. And Leslie burst out laughing. And I said, what are you laughing at? So that's what Larry Tisch said. Anyway, I have reason to believe that Mike Jordan, who's chairman of Westinghouse, would like to be what I thought Larry Tisch wanted to be, which was another Bill Paley, another David Sarnoff, another Leonard Goldenson. There aren't many guys. Tom Murphy is terrific at Cap Cities. Murdoch and Ted Turner, you know, they're hell on wheels. They're terrific. I mean, they're moving and they're thinking, and CBS has been mired nowhere, you know, worrying about the price of the stock instead of how many people are watching the network. I have a feeling that Mike Jordan at Westinghouse would looked around, and he looked at the Jerry Levins, and he looked at the Michael Eisners, and he looked at the Ted Turners, and he said, hey, that's how to get to be a force in this country. Nobody cares about who makes atomic engines or refrigerators, which they don't make anymore. And I think he's really serious that he wants to be a force in broadcasting. Would I bet the ranch on it? No. I got fooled once before. But I do think maybe this guy is serious about wanting to reconstitute a first-class network.
Well, what would it really take to produce a first-class network at CBS? Money, right?
Okay. Somebody's got to loosen up the purse strings. My understanding is that they paid about 5.3 for the company, and they have about 7.5 in their war chest, and that's pretty good money to start buying reporters and buying producers and reconstituting the entertainment end of CBS, which is in even worse shape than CBS News is. Money, 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 money.
Was it a big mistake for CBS to build Walter Cronkite as sort of a superhuman god just a few years before he was due for retirement and then leave a board?
No. Nobody built Walter Cronkite as anything other than what Walter Cronkite really was. There was no way you couldn't build Walter Cronkite that way. And it didn't just happen at the time that Walter was about to retire. Walter was sort of everybody's uncle. I was there at the time, first time it ever happened in America, after the Kennedy assassination. He was shaken. They didn't go to church. They went to the television set. And they, in fact, said, Walter Cronkite, tell us everything is going to be all right. And the whole country came to the set, and everybody held hands, and Walter calmed everybody down. That's a role that he never sought. It's a role that Jennings, Rather, and Brokaw play now to a lesser degree. I don't think anybody in television ever sought that role. It just happened. It just happens at times of stress. Everybody runs to a television set to be reassured that the world didn't disappear. I remember once Mike Deaver and I were talking up at Harvard at the Kennedy School, and these kids were very interested in what happened at the White House at the time of a crisis. One of the kids got up and he said, "Mr. Deaver, when a crisis breaks out in the world, what happens in that White House Situation Room?" Mike said, "We all turn on CNN." Which has become a unifying force in the world. CNN is sort of the glue that holds the world together these days. They're incredible. None of us ever thought, did you ever think they were going to be where they are? When they started that thing, we all laughed at it. It was a silliness. You know, it isn't. That's right. How are you going to fill up a thing with 24 hours in it? They are great. They're terrific. Yes.
What television reporter today comes closest to the ideal of your friend and colleague Ed Murray, if anybody does?
Well, I think collectively the team on 60 Minutes does, because they have the same ardor, fervor about what they do. I'm a very big fan of Peter Jennings. I think Jennings is marvelous. I think Ted Koppel's Nightline is something that Ed Morrow couldn't have done any better than Ted does it, and would have been very proud to be part of it.
I'm not going any further. I'll insult somebody.
Well, you mentioned CNN and the All News Network. Do you expect that the 30-minute news broadcast suffering and will continue to suffer because of the CNN headline news and the fast-breaking stories that the network airs frequently? And do you consider that the cable industry will preempt some of the reports you wish to air on your network?
Sure. The big effect that CNN had on network broadcasting is that the local stations, to stay competitive, have to be fed stories in the afternoon so they can stay competitive with CNN that they were never fed before. If a Sadat is assassinated, if there's a plane crash somewhere, you used to have to wait till 6:30 or 7 o'clock for the evening news on NBC, ABC, or CBS to find out about it. No longer. There is little or nothing on an evening newscast on the network now that hasn't already been on a local station during the day, because they've got to keep that local station competitive with CNN. So the day of the network newscast may very well be coming to a close unless somebody has enough sense to know how to change it and make it different from the local broadcast that preceded it. There is little or nothing that you learn from a network broadcast that you wouldn't have found out if you watched the local broadcast before it.
You were one of the producers who invented TV coverage of the conventions with their elaborate booths. How, therefore, can you be critical what this kind of coverage is today?
You're right. Whoever said that is right. I guess everybody at some point in his life created a monster. And I was in this crazy competitive business and created a monster. I did things in those days that if somebody who worked for me did them today, I'd fire them. Yeah, good question. I stand guilty as charged.
Do you have any plans to reshuffle the reporters on 60 Minutes? Although they have high credibility, some of them are getting too old to give fresh impressions to an audience.
Long in the tooth, I think. I'll put those five guys up against any kids in television. They spend more time on the road. They are more serious about what they do. They're the best in the business. Will we be there forever? I remember once ABC once said that they were going to take on 60 Minutes because Wallace and Hewitt couldn't live forever. And Mike and I said, no, they're wrong. I got to tell you a great story. I insist I tell you this. Mike and I were on a plane about 5-6 years ago, and we hadn't taken off from Los Angeles. And he got up to get something at the rack on the top. He didn't crumble. He went down like a tree in a forest. And he landed on his face, and he was out. And I looked over, and I saw him lying there. And I'll show you how competitive all of us are. My first thought was, oh, shit, he's dead. Now we're never going to catch Cheers. Mike loves that so much. Mike said he would like on his tombstone, Mike Wallace is dead. Now we'll never catch Cheers. These guys are dynamite. I mean, Mike is in Cambodia. One day he's in Des Moines. The next day, Morley's off to God knows where in Africa. They age has nothing whatsoever to do with it, and we wouldn't have stayed where we were all these years. You know, there's something good about age. There's something good about that familiar. There's so little in America that still looks the way it did when you were a kid. The supermarkets look different. The gas stations look different. 60 Minutes looks exactly the same. Nothing has changed. It's kind of like, and I think it's kind of refreshing. It's like when you go back to visit Grandpa and the screen door still squeaks, and you'd be very disappointed if somebody oiled it. Well, I don't want to oil it. I want to let it squeak a little.
At times, 60 Minutes has been accused of being unfair, illegal, biased, liars, what have you. How do you and your attorneys protect show and negotiate out-of-court settlements?
Well,
if there are any.
This is our 28th year on the air. We have never lost a lawsuit, ever. We once settled out of court. It was a Colombian drug dealer. He settled for $5,000. This is about 20 years ago. The money is still waiting for him in a bank in New York. And I said, I'm not taking it to Columbia, that's for sure. If he wants to come to New York and get his money, it's still there, earning interest. But that's the only time we ever settled out of court. We've never lost a lawsuit. We've got good lawyers who look at everything, as I'm sure, you know. But there are dangers now. The threat of lawsuits is now making a lot of people very gun-shy. Is it Red Lion? The Red Lion food market thing that's now up.
Food Lion.
Yes. That Primetime Live is up against. ABC caved to Philip Morris because the company couldn't stand to lose $15 billion. We've got one right now. I can't go into the details of it, but we've got a gun pointed at our head, a $15 billion. So we have a story that we think is solid. We don't think anybody could ever sue us for libel. There are some twists and turns. And if you get in front of a jury in some state where all the people in that jury related to people who work in tobacco companies, look out. That's a $15 billion gun pointed at your head. We may opt to get out of the line of fire. It doesn't make me proud, but it's not my money. I don't have $15 billion. That's Larry Tisch. No lawsuits ever lost.
About being liars?
Yeah.
You answer that.
No. We always tell the truth. The whole truth and nothing but the truth. Back on cameras in the courtroom, in your opinion, should court TV be asked to leave the air as soon as possible?
No. I told that to Steve Brill. I just think that I know we're on C-SPAN, so I don't want to butter them up, but I think a trial on C-SPAN where you sit there and it just runs, but it's that interruption. It's every one of them, even court TV, they have an opening title. CNN had music, opening title, then they go to the guy. It's like a football game. And the two guys sit there like Summerall and Madden, and they tell you what the quarterback should have done that he didn't do and why they should have gone for it on fourth down instead of punting. And it makes a mockery of the whole thing. I think if they didn't make it into a television show, if you could tune in and just watch it with a camera there, just watching it with no commentary, and watch the trial and not have every time there's an interruption, it's like the timeout in a football game. They walk up to the bench, they interrupt, okay, they go away to a commercial, they come back, they got an instant replay of what happened before they went, and then they have Summerall and Madden, and they'll tell you what Marcia Clark should have done that she didn't do. It's undignified, it's wrong, and I think there probably is a way to do a courtroom with a little dignity, and I don't think you can sell Pampers out of a murder trial.
Do you feel the New York Times stubbed its toe by doing an interview with O.J. on his terms?
I'm not sure it was on his terms. I don't think they ever said it was an interview. You got a phone call from O.J., and that's what he said. I think Bill Carter said that this was the net result of my interview with O.J., and I don't think there were any ground rules because I don't think he said any more than that. So I don't think they left anything out. I wasn't disturbed by that.
All right, you've made your views known on coverage of the O.J. trial, but even if you eliminated cameras from the courtroom, let's face it, if you watch local television news, is it anything more than a daily report on crime in the community? And how responsible that kind of news for the spread of national cynicism?
Well, I think whatever the sins of local television are, they're minuscule compared to the talk shows. I think between the Geraldo Rivera, Ricky Lake, Holly Perez, their names now, I don't even heard of half these people. Every day there's a new talk show, and they deal with subjects like, I had an affair with my mother, I slept with my grandmother.
I mean, I would think that one of the things that I don't understand is that the same men and women who sit on the boards of directors of concert orchestras, art museums, hospitals, universities, sit on the boards of broadcasting companies that put this on the air. Doesn't anybody ever get up at a board meeting and say, what are we doing to this country? Why are we doing this? And I don't understand it.
All right, you've given your views on talk show hosts, but how about the rise of talking head panels, such as the McLaughlin Group and others that discuss the news of the day?
Wait a minute, my answer. Why are all these in the same handwriting? Did you write these?
They're not.
Yes, they are. You wrote them. You're sitting there writing.
I want to keep you on your toes.
Listen, everybody complains about McLaughlin, right? Everybody watches him. It's, you know, he's like my father used to hate Westbrook Pegler when he wrote the Scripps Howard. He wouldn't miss Westbrook Pegler for the world because he hated him so he wanted him. Nobody misses McLaughlin because it's a great act. It's a terrific act. It's a showbiz act, and you know, with that booming voice that, you know, you got to get up and put the mute on. But anyway, no, I got no problem with that. And they're not doing that. I sleep with my grandmother.
But you think they add to the body of knowledge by just interesting an audience?
Yeah. I think I would think that Capitol Hill Gang and Crossfire, I think they do add something. There's an act, you know. I mean, you got to find a John Sununu and a Kinsley and Novak. There's a anyway. But you listen to all this baloney and you sit there and you take something out of it. You may reject 90% of it, but there's 10% in there that you walk away thinking, hey, maybe they got a point. What the point is, I'm not sure, but they got a point.
A question on advertising today. Do you see any improvement?
It's the same handwriting.
No, it is not. Do you see any improvement in the advertising commercial today? Are the commercials any worse today than when anchors smoke Camels on the air during?
Can I ask a question? Who here is old enough to remember John Cameron Swayze in the Camel News Caravan? Sorry, a couple of guys. Commercials are good. Commercials are well done. The guys who direct and produce commercials are probably better than the guys who produce and direct television shows. Perfect example. Murphy Brown was great, and it's beginning to run out of steam. Andy Bergen is terrific on those telephone commercials. They're wonderful, and whoever directs her in those and whoever writes them, you want to get from Murphy Brown. They're terrific.
You've spent your whole life behind the camera. Do you ever get the urge to sit out front in the anchor chair?
No. I don't even know why I came here.
Has Dan Rather...
That's different writing.
That's right. Has Dan Rather had a facelift, or is it just the horizontal hole on my TV?
I don't think he has. Not that I know of. I mean, if he has, it I don't know. I doubt it.
How do you think the new small digital camcorders and the concept of the video journalist, the reporter working alone with these cameras, will affect television news?
I think it's great. I think they get into places that no one else gets. It's what Friendly used to call the 200-pound pencil. Now it's not much bigger than a pencil. I think anytime anybody in journalism can blend in with a crowd and be less obtrusive, that's a plus. I think it's great. I don't see any reason why it shouldn't be done. Plus, the unions are raising hell because unions always want more people on the story. But anytime you can sneak a camera in anywhere and meld in with the crowd, which is what good reporters do. Good reporters don't walk around with a press card stuck in their hat. They kind of walk in, they sit in the back of the room, they listen, and that may enable people to do that. Of course, they'll get sued, but that's all right.
Do you plan to broadcast an update on Morley Safer's famous French paradox story on red wine? Will this story include beer and liquor as well?
Hold on a minute. Who's this? Yeah, we're going to do that in a couple of weeks, and yes, it will. And there's a study that shows that alcohol is probably better for you than anyone ever imagined. And I don't want to be around when AA starts asking for equal time.
Can you film it in the bar upstairs?
We will do it right here with one of those small cameras.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Before we get to our final question, a couple of gifts. First, a certificate of appreciation for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And then our famous National Press Club mug, which you can treasure and use to stay awake while you're fighting with Mike Wallace over students.
Terrific. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Last question. You've alluded to this, but somebody asks it again, and they want a very specific answer, and I have to be careful with my inflection because I don't want to tilt you one way or the other, okay?
Go tilt me.
When will you retire?
I'm 73, and my contract's up when I'm 78, and I don't think I'm going to retire then. I may die in the office, which would be the only way to die. Anybody should die at work. I know I'm going to be around for 5 more years. Well, I don't know I'm going to be around 5 more years. I may not make it to the airport. But anyways, if I am around, I'll be at CBS for another 5 years. And there are a lot of people who say, why doesn't that son of a bitch retire and make room for somebody else? Well, wouldn't know what to do with myself if I didn't go to work every day. So I'm not going to retire. Okay?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Hewitt. I think everybody found your speech and answers to questions very informative and interesting. I want to thank you all in the audience for being with us, and good afternoon.
Well done, as usual.
Run out of
questions. Yeah,
we'll
get
you a
drink.
You're
too nice.
Is that
right?
Oh, you're marvelous. You're all very talented.
Nice to see you.
Thank you. Don't you ever retire.
I'm not going to retire. Don't you retire.
Oh, thanks for being so my name. Give it away. Do it. Perfect. That's the president. Press conference you can have out.
I don't know what it's like
if you want to.
Well, all I have is the road. The place is bothered.
Oh, yes. I mean, we do have a lot of functions here. Inaugural.